Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Welcome to Virginia Conversations. I'm your host, May Lily Lee, and I approved this message. That's a tagline you've probably heard a few hundred times, even if you are just a casual television viewer. And with Labor Day being the traditional kickoff to the campaign season, expect to hear it a lot more in the coming weeks. Campaign spending for television time in Virginia this year has already broken previous records. The Commonwealth is ranked number 3 in the top 10 presidential battleground states and has a hotly contested U.S. Senate race. That means people in our area are seeing a lot of the candidates in person and on television. Robbie Harris has this report.
Hello, Roanoke! Oh, it is good to be back in Virginia.
The presidential candidates have visited Virginia numerous times this year.
To say we want to get more jobs for people in the middle class and more take-home pay.
But it's a big country and a close election. So what better way to keep a presence in a key state than to be on television here?
You haven't seen anything yet. It's crazy. It's going to wind up being about 25% of the total advertising in the market.
Jack Poor is vice president of TVB, the nonprofit trade association for the commercial broadcast television industry.
TV news has an older demographic. It's like 35 plus. Usually that's a problem, but in politics that's an asset. The other thing it does, it's intrusive. And the thing that our friends on the online video world who are trying to, you know, get TV money, the thing that they've got going against them is most of the time online video is user-initiated. People aren't going to initiate political ads. They don't like them. So they were used to television interrupting them, though.
But this time around, not only are the candidates pouring money into TV time, so are outside organizations known as super PACs. And they're not only changing the game, they're changing the rules.
There are specific PACs, aside from the Republican Senate Committee and the Democratic Senate Committee, that are specifically devoted to recapturing the Senate in the Republican case and recapturing the Congress in the Democratic case, and vice versa. So there's money not really associated with the particular candidates, but associated with retaining or getting the seat itself.
But while contributions to candidates in federal election campaigns are limited to no more than $5,000,
Virginia is one of the few states where there are no campaign contribution limits. If you were running for your local board of supervisors or city council, I could donate $1 million to your campaign, which would be illegal in most states.
David Poole is executive director of the Virginia Public Access Project.
So Virginia is a state that relies almost entirely upon transparency and disclosure for the regulation of campaign finance donations.
Poole says the Virginia Public Access Project's role is to help foster that transparency through its website, which clearly shows details about who is contributing what to whom. It lists donors by name, amount of money, and where they work. In the interest of privacy, it does not list addresses. But since all donations are public record, anyone who donates to a candidate or a PAC is there for anyone to see.
We certainly don't have a situation where there's not enough information. People are drowning in information. We're trying to organize it in smart, elegant ways so people can make sense of things.
Next week, the Virginia Public Access Project, or VPAP as it's known, will release a report detailing the TV buys, not by the campaigns themselves, but of third-party groups.
We could spend our time tracking money spent by candidates, but that's not really telling the entire story. In fact, in some elections, some congressional elections, the majority of money may be spent by outside groups. So unless you really kind of get that picture as well, you're not presenting a very full picture. So we decided to focus on this new growing area that is really going to have a big effect on these elections.
I'm Robbie Harris.
As Robbie reported in her piece, besides all the TV ads, the candidates themselves haven't exactly been strangers to Virginia. From Mitt Romney's announcement of his running mate Paul Ryan on the deck of the USS Wisconsin in Norfolk, to Joe Biden's visit that unintentionally helped the business of a Radford bakery, to this week's visit to Charlottesville by President Obama, and the newly nominated GOP ticket later today in Richmond, our purple state is red hot in politics this year. Our guests today are three men immersed in the world of politics. Bob Gibson, executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. He's coming to us from Charlottesville. Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And Mike Sluss, political reporter for the Roanoke Times, both of them coming from Richmond. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I'm going to start with you, Mike. The fact that Obama had a chance to come in this week means that he could address his "you didn't build that" statement, which became so famous. And let's talk about the deconstruction of that.
Sure. That piece began with Obama shouting, "Hello, Roanoke," and that was a speech where he inadvertently gave Republicans some ammunition that they're continuing to fire at him several weeks later. It was in that speech in front of the historic fire station number one in Roanoke that he was talking about how education and infrastructure, government has a role in developing that to support commerce and business. And leading up to the statement that has been isolated and used in attack ads since then, he said, "Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you've got a business, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen." It was the last two sentences there that have been used over and over by the Romney campaign and Republicans to make the argument that this crystallizes Obama's attitude toward business and entrepreneurs. And it must have been effective because within a week, Obama cut his own ad to say that his remarks were being taken out of context and that he does understand that small business owners are responsible for their own success. So we had no idea when this campaign started that that Roanoke could end up, merely for its setting, being such a...
A lightning rod.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is it too late? By the time Obama comes back and deconstructs that, is the damage already done? Let's try that question for you, Jeff.
Well, one of the problems, of course, in politics is that politicians are not just competing with each other. They're competing with round-the-clock television, nonstop sports, 24-hour entertainment. So what little the voting public absorbs is often fairly trivial, very emotive, and in that respect, this is a problematic issue for Obama. I guess listening to the Democrats, they would say that as far as the Republicans' use of this rhetorical flourish is concerned, they've bilked that.
By the way, we have a question for our listeners. Those of you who are joining in this conversation, we're interested to know which television ad are you most tired of at this point? You've been inundated already, and there's more to come. We're interested to find out which ones are sticking in your craw. Let's get back to you, Mike. I want to find a little bit more about your travels this week. You ended up getting a change of venue.
Yeah, I had, and it speaks again to the importance of Virginia in the presidential election. There's a red-hot Senate race, white-hot Senate race, actually, in Virginia between two former governors, Tim Kaine and George Allen, that most expect will closely track the presidential race in terms of outcome. So I had hoped to be out on the road with Governor Allen today, but Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, when they leave Florida this morning, are heading straight here to Richmond, and there will be a heavy Republican presence, a show of unity there at the airport, and that's where Governor Allen will be as well.
Could you give us a primer, Jeff, on why Virginia has become so important for those who, let's pretend that they're neophytes to the political world. Why is Virginia factoring so hugely in this?
Well, Virginia, for so long, kind of the nation in terms of its politics, is now very much of the nation, with a population of 8 million plus. About half the people who live here were not born here. That means those come-heres bring their politics to this state. A lot of that is straight ticket voting, which complicates things for the Alan Kane race. Also, the demographic snapshot of Virginia is much different than it was. This is not a state that is as heavily white as it once was. Minorities, the new Virginians, if you will, Asians, Latinos, have driven the minority population of this state up to 33%. And there's an asterisk that should be placed along that. Though Virginia is now a multi-hued state, its electorate, people who actually register to exercise the franchise, it's still lopsidedly white, and there haven't been as significant an increase in registration among those new Virginians as there has been in the population as a whole. But this is a much more dynamic, much more suburban state than it once was. It is, depending on one's perspective, not as much of the South as perhaps of the Mid-Atlantic.
The number to call is 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. Adisha from Norfolk, you have a question or comment?
Yes, Jeff, Bob, Mike, how you doing? It's Adisha. How is everything?
Good morning.
How's Trix?
Things are fine. Wanted to know what you guys thought of, you know, sort of Bob McDonald sort of slowly diminishing role on the national stage. I mean, he started out, you know, as a vice presidential prospect and ended up, you know, doing the convention, doing a lot of work for Mitt Romney and not the prominent roles that a lot of us expected him to have. What are your comments and thoughts on that?
Well, perhaps Mike will take a swing at that, but in the interest of full disclosure, that's Adisa Muse, a Democratic operative, calling from Norfolk. He's working on the Alexander Senate campaign. And with that, Michael.
Okay. Well, I think you described Governor McDonald's role as workmanlike. I think perhaps you're referring to his role chairing the platform committee at the convention, which was sort of a story unto itself because there has been a lot said and written about whether Governor Romney will adhere to the abortion plank in that platform, and he has tried and has said that he does believe there should be exceptions in the case of rape, incest, and the life of the mother. But I think Governor McDonald still is going to have a prominent role as a surrogate, whether it's on the stump here in Virginia, on cable television, and the Sunday talk shows for the duration of the campaign. That says something about him, but more about the importance of Virginia as a swing state in the electoral map. So I think we're still going to see and hear a lot from the governor here over the next, 66 days to the election.
Bob Gibson, do you want to dovetail off of that?
He was treated sort of as one of a number of governors and a parade of governors at the convention, given speaking times that network anchors were talking over if you were watching one of the cable channels on Tuesday night. So he did not get the time that perhaps he deserved, given all the work he'd done over the months leading up to the convention.
Perhaps to Adisa's question, the governor had a high profile, or somewhat elevated profile, at the convention because of his role as GOP platform chair, this consolation prize, if you will, having been considered for and passed over for the vice presidency. But a number of these very sensitive, hot-button cultural and social issues that are addressed in the platform, including some very rigid restrictions on abortion. These are data points that are part of a pattern in Bob McDonald's political life that he has tried to play down, to, you know, come across as a kind of happy face conservative, but it just kind of keeps coming back. There was the debate this winter over abortion ultrasounds, these mandatory non-medical exams that women considering abortions would have to undergo. And that debate went a long way nationally toward perhaps projecting the image that Bob McDonnell has worked hard not to project. Needless to say, many of us remember how he was essentially reduced to a punchline because of this issue in those political comedy shows that have become increasingly important as sources of political information.
Pat from Virginia Beach, there's an ad you've grown tired of.
Yes, the ad that I'm most tired of is the one suggesting that Obama is going to change the welfare laws and to simply send out checks to undeserving welfare queens. And I think the implication is that we are regressing to a sort of pre-Clinton point of welfare queens, which Reagan, in his good government days, tried to stomp out. And that, combined with the he didn't build that ad, sends a signal to people who are not totally observant at this point that Obama is all about big government. And in some quarters, it could be effective.
Thank you for your comment. Mike?
Well, this is interesting because welfare reform in the 90s was a hot-button political issue in Virginia and nationally. What happened was... earlier this summer, the Department of Health and Human Services announced that they would provide waivers, if states applied for them, to the welfare-to-work requirement. But a condition of the waivers was that that the alternative arrangement that states made had to be a more effective process of moving welfare recipients to full employment. And I believe of the five governors who initially requested that the Obama administration do this, two were Republican governors. Nonetheless, a couple of weeks, I think, passed before this was seized upon by the Romney campaign to say that the president was trying to gut the work requirement. And Jeff, you would know better than me. I believe the fact checkers at your newspaper took a look at this, particularly after the governor wrote an op-ed piece in your newspaper making this same claim.
Yes, the fact checkers at the Times-Dispatch and elsewhere have pointed out that this is mostly false or specious, if you will, that what's actually going on here is that the states, Virginia would be certainly among them, having made some very significant changes in its own welfare laws, are essentially developing better ways to deliver welfare, public assistance, but preserving that condition that recipients work or go to school or engage in some type of job training. There was a piece on NPR this morning about this. One person made the point that isn't this really all about federalism, the national government turning to the states to develop some better ideas?
Fred from Norfolk, hold on with us because I'm going to go to break and remind everyone that you're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today we're discussing campaign spending and stump speeches in the state by the candidates for the White House. Next week, we'll take a look at the toll student debt puts on college graduates, avoiding and digging out of campus debt. Next time, stay with us. We're back in a moment. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today, the topic is campaign spending and appearances in the state by the candidates for president and vice president. Our guests are Bob Gibson, executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Mike Sluss, political reporter for the Roanoke Times. Bob, I wanted to check in with you to see if you had anything to add to our last conversation.
Well, I think a lot of the fact-checking that's been done doesn't always get out to the people who are seeing these paid ads. So what really matters is the amount of money that's being poured in, often by these third-party groups, the super PACs and others, who are trying to influence the election by taking a fact or a statement and twisting it out of context and putting it on so many times that the fact-checkers don't have time to catch up with it.
Fred from Norfolk actually wants to comment on that. Fred, what is your comment or question about facts in ads?
Well, I think he just nailed it directly on the head. I have never been more frustrated, outraged, and angry at the fact that the way the media, for the most part, just mainly glazes or glosses over that which is an outright lie. And I don't understand why the media just doesn't do a good job of calling it like it is. And, you know, as a voter, it's enormous. I mean, you know, Romney is Romney, Obama is Obama, fine, so be it. But to go to the extent to attempt to mislead voters by providing us with distorted, false information that is an outright lie is just mind-boggling. There's a business off of a main road that has a sign plastered about, yes, I did build this, and we know for a fact what the president was talking about. And it just concerns me that this election, as tight as it is, to have that type of information out there and it not being nipped in the bud, as the old folks used to say. So I'm just curious to know, as a voter, how do we grapple with outright lies and distortions? I'll take the response off there.
Yeah, Mike, do you want to take that?
Yeah, and, you know, I think at our paper, at least with Obama's Roanoke speech, because it happened in our backyard, we did take the time and the effort to deconstruct that and to try to provide context, especially as the attacks on that escalated. I think his criticism is fair. I think also some of the state papers that are covering presidential politics for maybe the first time, there is a resource and capacity issue when it comes to breaking down a lot of these national issues. And I think to some degree we may be more focused on what's going on in the Senate race. There's a lot of parallels as far as the issues go there. But I certainly understand where the caller is coming from.
We have a call from Mike from Stanton. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, this is a little off topic, but the right forum, I think, to discuss this. When I was in school, we learned that our representative government implied that none of us could know enough to make laws, and so we were to elect smart, intelligent, and ethical people to go to Congress and the State House to find out the facts and then vote laws that were for the general good. And the talking heads on AM radio make it sound like the people are so smart that the fact that our legislators don't just vote our proxy is at least half of the people that I have queried about this believe that their congressmen should vote as a proxy, essentially, for their constituents, even if it's absurd. I mean, half the people in an area can think that segregation is good or even more absurd things. And it seems to me that somebody, if not NPR, which never does it, ought to keep hammering away at the notion that we should be electing smart representatives rather than people who will vote on particular issues exactly the way we, the dumbheads out here, think.
Bob Gibson, director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. This sounds like one you could take.
Well, at the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, we do find and train smart and intelligent and ethical people for office. And I don't think the problem is as deep as the gentleman was referring to in Virginia as it is perhaps in the federal government and other places. I think we still have smart, intelligent, and ethical people by and large. But one thing that makes it difficult for politicians is when they try to vote their constituency and their constituency is divided. And on many of these social issues, our constituencies in Virginia are sharply divided. So which way a congressman or someone in elective office chooses to vote has to be based on more than just the polls.
Well, I would only add that that our elective representatives, state legislators, and members of Congress may be smart, ethical, and intelligent, but increasingly they are inattentive. And they are inattentive in large part because of the manner in which legislative districts are drawn. It's hyper-partisan. This is an exercise in kind of a computer-driven surgery. And one of the consequences of hyper-partisan redistricting is that very narrow bands of the electorate increasingly have a disproportionate amount of influence. And that tends to isolate a lot of us. So I suspect that the listener in Stanton is onto something.
And I think Jeff's right. I think we just came off a redistricting process in Virginia last year. And especially with the precision of the technology they use now, it really has amounted to lawmakers choosing their voters rather than the other way around. You have districts that are, in many cases, not homogenous but close to it. You don't have the kind of competition that creates this clash of ideas that maybe more voters are hungry for.
Right now we have Adam from Newport News. Go ahead, Adam.
Hi there. Actually, I was calling about the negative ads, specifically the Super PAC ads that aren't affiliated with the camps. And I don't like any of these Super PAC ads because most of them, it seems like in memory, are actually negative and not positive. And I was also wondering if the different political camps are hindered by some of these Super PAC ads and if there's anything that they do or try to do about it.
Bob, do you want to take that?
They are some of the nastiest ads that run on television, and they run in great volume. They are bombarding us in Virginia because we're such a swing state right now. So there's no question that we're being bombarded, and the campaigns don't necessarily like, although I'm sure they have some implicit coordination since the folks who run the super PACs are often very, very close to the candidates themselves from former campaigns or their staffs. So there is a fiction being perpetrated on the American voter that these are completely independent. They're doing great bombardment. They're doing it with large amounts of money, sometimes the source of which is unclear, and they're doing it in at least loose conjunction with the campaigns, although they say that there is no direct coordination.
And while recent studies indicate that, if you look at the legacy media, print and broadcast television are still very important in terms of candidates telling their stories and voters listening or interpreting that story, this increasingly narrowly sliced media spectrum allows the candidates and their proxies to be increasingly nasty and essentially in the privacy of your own home or whatever handheld you favor. So a lot of this is echoing through the Twitter sphere as well and throughout the Internet spectrum.
And I think the political strategists who devise these things will tell you that the reason you see the flood of these ads is because they believe they work, despite polls that say the contrary. And I have a feeling that we've only scratched the surface of it, that once we get past Monday and the holiday, this stuff is going to accelerate and become much more intense for the last 2 months.
Moving from television to your telephone, Kate from Roanoke, you have a comment.
Yes, I have been receiving calls for people who wish to do surveys, and they are obviously one-sided. I ran into one this past week that they couldn't... The caller did not even appropriately pronounce the name of the President of the United States, even after the third time that I corrected him. I think that he was told to use an incorrect pronunciation. I also ran into survey questions that I knew were specious. And I find this very disturbing. I am interested in politics, and I like to help with surveys, but I find this very disturbing.
Jeff, where are these phone surveys coming from? Give Kate a little guidance about what she's been bombarded with.
Well, they're coming from the campaigns themselves. They are coming from allied organizations, lots and lots of people. And that the listener actually had a conversation with an interviewer is interesting because, as well in polling, there's a lot of what is known as touch tone polling, in which someone is solicited and, you know, completes an answer by hitting a button on the phone. And within the data gathering, data crunching world, there's a lot of debate over whether these are indeed accurate, if polls are accurate, at least as snapshots in time. And there's another complication in polling as more and more of us move away from the copper line, hardwired landline, and take our calls on a mobile. And so as the samples of phone numbers are put together so that these polls can be conducted, they increasingly include larger and larger numbers of folks who don't have landlines, who prefer mobile communications.
And if we do grow tired of these, we can add ourselves to the Do Not Call registry, or we can just keep getting them and be entertained. Jim from Suffolk, you have a question or comment.
Yeah, and I'll try to be very brief. One of the situations that I find most disturbing in all of the debate is that the word politics, the word politician, and even the phrase the government all seem to be warped and skewed to mean things that you can't find that definition of it in any sort of Webster's. Politics is the business of the people. Politics is not a game played by parties one against another. Politics is not a game. It's the business of the people. And we either hire, elect, or are appointed individuals that are thought to be, by the voters or the people hiring them to do jobs in government, thought to be operating under the guise and the level of the business of the people. Politicians are therefore people who are hired, elected, whatever, to do the business of the people. And so the people should not think of politics or politicians as some dirty 7- or 8-letter word. We ought to be thinking of it as what it really is. And when people say the government is doing this and the government is doing that, they're separating themselves out from the government. They're saying it as if they have no say, no hand in the operation of the government at any level. So the fact that, especially with young people coming up and hearing these skewed statements and definitions, we need to get back to understanding what it really all is, and then maybe people would have a little more sense of interest or involvement.
Thank you for your comment. Jim's comment actually echoes Mike from Stanton, and he discussed democracy and what it means. I think, Bob Gibson, this might be yours to take.
I wouldn't disagree with the caller at all. I don't think politics has to be viewed as dirty. Campaigning often is dirty, but there is a difference between the business of the people, which is done through the elective process, and the campaigns that are increasingly being run with larger amounts of money over longer periods of time, with bombardments of ads that twist and negatively portray individuals and statements and twist the truth. So the politics that we all engage in doesn't have to be dirty. Campaigning, unfortunately, has become an exceedingly negative context because of the amounts of money that are spent and the effectiveness of these ads that drive public opinion.
Well, if one looks at the political class, using Virginia as an example, I think an argument can be made that this doesn't necessarily look like Virginia as a whole. Now, I think it's perhaps reflective in large part of the inattentiveness of the electorate. You essentially get the government for which you just didn't bother to vote at all. And so we have this elective class that seems to be more representative of these, you know, kind of narrow slices of the electorate. And it brings to mind that that line, it's been attributed to any number of people, that politics is essentially Hollywood for ugly people.
I think, too, Jeff was talking a few minutes ago about how candidates can use technology now to sort of narrow cast their message. And I think there's less hands-on retail politics that goes on these days. And there's sort of a gulf between a candidate and the voters that they're speaking to. And I think that's probably contributes to the sort of cynicism that the caller was talking about.
Tom from Williamsburg, you have a comment about negative ads?
Yeah, it's like, as far as these negative ads, they're so bad, it's to a point that I don't even watch television because of the ads. I feel like it's just one infomercial after another trying to sell me a product I really don't want to hear about. And I'm just wondering, is there any room in the future for where it's almost like a job application, where if you're running for a political office, you produce maybe a biography that's available on any media source with references so you can check your accomplishments and let that stand for itself and not all this hate between each other? And really, whether you're a president or a congressman or a senator, as far as being reelected, your merits, how well you perform, should be the caliber that measures whether you're reelected, not how much money you can spend and what your promises are going to be in the future. Because, quite frankly, my wife is in business. She hires a lot of people. And you can only judge them by the information they give you. And you're not quite sure how they're going to work out until they get in that spot anyway. So
okay.
Even...
Well, let's take that as we take a break here and comment on that. But right now you're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We'll have more on the race for the White House. As always, I want to remind you that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. Virginia Conversations will continue in a minute. And we are back. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today the topic is campaign spending and appearances in the state by the candidates for president and vice president. Our guests are Bob Gibson, executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Mike Sluss, political reporter for the Roanoke Times. Tom from Williamsburg made a point about the negative ads. Mike, you want to take that?
Yeah, and I wonder if part of this is just sort of kind of a shock value, because Virginia really hasn't been exposed to the volume of ads that we're seeing in this cycle. It speaks to our status as a swing state. And also, in the aftermath of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision a couple of years ago, we're seeing the super PACs and the independent expenditure groups flooding the airwaves as well. So there's sort of a climate this year that we really haven't had to deal with before. So I wonder if some of this is just a function of sensory overload. I can certainly can understand how that would be the case. I know a few weeks ago I was in South Carolina the weekend that the Olympics started, and then a couple of days down there never saw a single political ad. When I came home a few days later, it seemed like every commercial break you were hammered with these. So welcome to Virginia. We've got two more months of this to go.
We've been talking about negative television ads, but we want to invite listeners to weigh in on negative bumper stickers, too. We've heard that in Southwest Virginia in particular, there are very vocal bumper stickers relating to Obama. Be interested to hear what is going on in other parts of the state as well. Jeff, you had a point.
To competition for the ears, hearts, and minds of voters, if if a politician has but seconds to get your attention because you might be watching a comedy show or you might be watching a movie, it's not surprising that the politician is going to emphasize something pretty simple, something pretty emotive, if you will, pretty trivial. That's a constant in politics. It's increasing exponentially, and it is particularly evident this year in Virginia because this is a swing state.
Gary from Charlottesville, you have a comment?
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
So I'm a little confused as to how we manage this. The negative advertising is completely out of control. The average person who's not a typical campaigner or not involved in campaigning as a volunteer is posting stuff on places like Facebook, Google+, and Twitter, and there's a lot of hate slinging that really has nothing to do with the issues. But we live in a democracy, and we have freedom of speech. And it seems like the campaigns are less and less targeted at the future of our country or what the candidate is actually running for. It's more about just getting the job and getting in office. I'm just curious if there is any legal ramifications or controls that can be placed on that to actually separate the lies, which a lot of this is, from truth and fact. I mean, how do we get the candidates to focus on the actual matters at hand and get away from the lack of truth in their advertising?
Bob Gibson?
The lies and lack of truth, unfortunately, are proliferating and with fewer controls because of a U.S. Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, which is allowing large, unlimited amounts of money from undisclosed sources to bombard the media and spread these twisted charges. There isn't much we can do until Congress acts. The Supreme Court left it up to Congress as to whether there will be transparency and disclosure, which is the Virginia way of handling campaigns. We have unlimited campaign contributions for any office in Virginia, which is tempered by the fact that there will be instant or nearly instant disclosure and transparency in who is giving the money. This is not true in the federal system, and it's something that Congress is charged with fixing and hasn't decided to fix yet.
Mike.
We started to see this in 2010, and listeners in Southwest Virginia may recall this. There was an independent expenditure group running attack ads against Congressman Rick Boucher. He objected so vehemently that he asked TV stations to take them down because he thought they so badly misrepresented the truth. One actually did take it down. This was the immediate aftermath of Citizens United, and I recall we did a story at the time where there was a gentleman with the Center for Responsive Politics who said that unless Congress acts, what you see in 2010 will be totally out of control in 2012. And I think that's how a lot of people feel when they watch TV these days.
Jeff?
Well, there's, of course, this free speech issue. Mike correctly notes that occasionally television stations or radio stations will pull down ads that they consider beyond the pale or just outlandish. But perhaps the antidote to all this is, greater attention, greater participation. It's no surprise that Obama carried the state in 2008. It was a 74% turnout. When more people participate in this state, the temperature of the electorate tends to be more moderate. Following year, Bob McDonnell, a Republican, was elected in a landslide, but a 46% turnout. So that speaks to the power of these kind of pockets within the electorate. If more people are involved, perhaps one will keep one's fingers crossed that the politicians will be more attentive of what they say.
When I used to play women's soccer, our coach used to say, just go ahead and tackle somebody in the end zone when there isn't a penalty kick. Not called the end zone, but that's how long it's been since I've played soccer. The point was, go ahead and earn the foul, take it for the team, and be as unethical as you need to save that point. So putting a negative ad out, not just negative, but one that contains lies, doesn't it serve its purpose and then it's too late? Isn't that sort of part of the idea when we see this kind of positioning?
Well, the rule in politics is a a claim that is not refuted is a claim confirmed. So that's why both campaigns pay very close attention to what the other and their surrogates are saying and move quickly, purposefully, to knock down whatever is being alleged.
And I think any penalty that would be attached to an ad like that would just be written off as the cost of doing business by whoever is sponsoring it.
Robin from Virginia Beach, you have a comment? Hi, Robin, are you there? Okay, let's stay in Virginia Beach, but let's try Dave.
I was listening to your show, and earlier you had mentioned someone was on talking about robocalls and this and that, and I just want to let you know that the only people that are exempt from the Do Not Call registry are politicians. And I don't know if you or your group or your panel knew that, but nationwide, you can't call and say, I don't want phone calls from Bob McDonald, I don't want phone calls from Barack Obama. They all get through, and it's perfectly legal. So just a little heads up for people out there, and just want to let you all know that.
The First Amendment.
Thank you, Jeff. Bob or Mike, do you want to add to that?
You know, it's funny, these calls, things disguised as polls are sometimes not polls or surveys at all, but are attempts to influence the electorate. And I think there a lot of the advertising that is going into our cable channels now is an attempt to depress and suppress the electorate, to keep certain people from voting by having them get so disgusted with politics and with the campaign that they will not vote. I was surveyed the other day. Normally I don't take these things, but I wanted to find out what the nature of the survey was. It was by the 60-plus group that is sort of a conservative alternative to AARP. And I answered all of the questions that I had not made up my mind. And now I'm getting tons of mail from people trying to help me make up my mind. So, some of these things are surveys and some of these things are other disguised surveys.
Jeff Shapiro.
To Bob Gibson's observation about voter suppression, add to that issue something that Virginia will have to deal with in this campaign, and that is voter ID. For someone to exercise the franchise, one would have to present a certain type of identity card. If not, your vote wouldn't count immediately until you could prove that you are who you claim to be. This could certainly scramble the calculus at the polls on Election Day. It's a big issue in a number of states, a big decision out of Texas throwing out its voter ID law.
Earlier, I was asking callers about those bumper stickers. Are there more out there this year than in years past? That would be an interesting question to get answered from some of you who are on the road. You know, we saw in the report by Robbie that Virginia is a state in which there are no campaign contribution limits. So David Poole of VPAP has pointed out that it becomes even more imperative to see who is contributing to campaigns, how much is being contributed. VPAP is a great source to find. If you want to Google VPAP.org, in what way is that significant for us?
In this election cycle, it's not significant because the contribution limit or lack thereof applies to state and local elections in Virginia. These are federal elections. The super PACs, however, the contributions there have no limits. So, again, it's the outside forces beyond the campaigns that are constrained by these limits that are wielding this influence we didn't see prior to 2010.
One of the things that VPAP is doing, however, is trying to cull from the list of super PAC donors the names of Virginians to point out how they are participating in this. And I think it's another measure of the increasingly national nature of Virginia politics.
Bob Gibson?
Well, I think Jeff's right, and VPAP does a good service, and they're trying to increase the amount of reporting they do on super PAC donations, so these opaque donations will have a little bit of reporting done on them next week by Virginia Political Access, VPAP, and I think it's going to be helpful to Virginia voters to see where the money is coming from to the extent that we can.
We have a call from Marguerite from Virginia Beach. Go ahead.
Yes. I've become increasingly concerned over the last several years that we as Americans seem to have lost our ability to engage in conversation and dialogue with one another, whereas at one time in our country's history, I think particularly about someone like Ben Franklin, who just really enjoyed debating with one another, but we could congratulate each other. Oh, that was a good point. I didn't think about that. So I've been considering this for a while, and I have a proposal, which I'm sure everybody out there in radio land will laugh at, but I'm wondering why we couldn't have platforms presented with no party label attached to it and no face attached to it. You vote for the idea that you think is going to most improve our country over the next 4 years, and then the party battles out who they want to have as the face on their platform after the country has decided on what we want to work on.
Marguerite, you're echoing one of the premises of the book, The Harbinger, that if we all engaged in greater dialogue rather than adversarial one-on-one shots, that we would get somewhere. It's interesting. Do you want to comment on that, Jeff?
Well, consider how politicians communicate. They don't simply engage each other in debate before the Chamber of Commerce or the well of the House of Representatives. They do so through television advertising, online, on radio. When Benjamin Franklin was at his prime, the debate was pretty much for members only. It took place in small rooms, and it was a long time before the public really found out what was going on. The speed with which these debates unfold, the manner in which they're reported, makes it increasingly difficult to comport oneself with civility.
Jenny from Roanoke, you're on the air.
All right, I just have a statement, and that is these negative ads, be they radio, TV, newspapers, printed, or whatever, are the same as bullying that we are trying to stop our students from doing when they have all these politicians as their role model on how to bully. Thank you.
So the word you're using is bullying? I didn't catch that. I didn't catch that one word. You said it's bullying?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for your comment, Jenny. And Michael from Roanoke, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you doing? Thank you for allowing me on.
Absolutely.
Okay. This is my solution. You know, you've heard of the...
let me get my pen out. Oh, you've got the solution. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
The V-chip in television is... blocks pornography and violence from kids. Take that out, take the program into that, put it all in another chip, and then we, anytime a politician shows up on the TV, it automatically switches over to another channel.
But for now, you'll just have to get your remote out and switch to the other channel.
People aren't looking at this silly enough.
I appreciate that. Thank you for the humor. David from Floyd, your question or comment.
I just had a statement on the bumper sticker that you guys mentioned.
Oh, there we go. We have a bumper sticker participant.
I had something that was kind of on the comedy side and then something on the not-so-comedy side. A bumper sticker I'd recently saw was if a working man voting Republican is similar to a chicken voting for Colonel Sanders. So that was one of the comedy sides of it. But on a serious note, my mom actually last night, it's funny to hear this on the radio today, but she had mentioned my wife's got an Obama bumper sticker on her car, and she said, I think we ought to probably remove those from our vehicle. Nothing, just Obama, Biden, that's it. Nothing, no other type of statement with it. But she said that she's been hearing and experiencing some kind of violent natures with people that are flicking her off, pointing at her car. When you're driving, you're kind of feeling the angriness of having that bumper sticker on your car.
Does it feel more prevalent now than in times past?
I'm not sure. This is recent that my wife and her has put a sticker on their car. I think they've had it on there for about 2 months, but you know, she's actually heard something, I think, on the radio or in print yesterday that there's been some verbal threats, and there's some folks that have made statements in the nature of, you know, I ought to shoot that person with an Obama sticker because they're obviously stupid and they don't need to be in the gene pool.
Well, David, I appreciate your coming in at the last minute with the bumper sticker observation. I think that was one I was looking forward to. Thank you so much. And I want to thank our guests, Bob Gibson of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Jeff Shapiro of the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Mike Sluss of the Roanoke Times. We appreciate your joining us here on Virginia Conversations. Be sure to join us next week when we talk about student debt. Until then, I'm May Lily Lee for Virginia Conversations.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.